We're on the Mishnah here on Daf Chaf Amid Aleph. Until now we've been discussing cases where we find the shtar as a result of the fact that the shtar was dropped. There's a race on the shtar that engenders various suspicions about the viability and the validity of the shtar, the kashas shtar. For example, we're afraid that perhaps in a case of a shtar chov, the chov was paid up. Perhaps even if the chov by admission of the love was not paid up, there's some sort of kinunya, some sort of collusion or cartel between the lov and the malva to be mafsid lekuchos. We also have a chash that perhaps it's a shtar muktam, and although the shtar was written on one date, it was not actually validated until a later date when the transaction took place. There are many, many different chashoshos. Our Mishnah here, however, in contrast, is going to establish in what cases finding a shtar allows us to return the shtar as soon as we can identify its owner, whether through simonim or through perhaps tvius ayin. We can return the shtar once we ascertain that this individual is claiming the shtar actually lost the shtar. We don't have to worry about piron, about kinunya, about hefsed alekuchos, about a shtar muktam, etc., etc. So here's the list. First on the list is matza igros shum. When Bezdin decides that the malv has rights to collect the lands, the real estate of the loveb, they do what's called a shuma, and they evaluate the market selling price of a particular piece of karka, and then they write that shuma, that evaluation, in a document. They give that document to the malva, and once the malva is equipped with that document, he can collect that land in payment in lieu of his chov, and that's the law of mishubadim. Later on, Rashi is going to explain that in these kinds of shtaros, the first of which is here, the igros shum, there's no chashash piron, there's no chashash of shema nimlach, because Bezdin writes this shtar after they've done what they've done, after what they can be mekayim, what was already mekuyam. In other words, they've already done the shuma, they've already evaluated and determined that the malva could collect a particular piece of karka, and that's written in the document. There's no reason why we should hesitate, once we ascertain who the malva is, returning that document. The second case on the list is igros mazon. These are shtaros that Bezdin write, and they do it on behalf of a wife as a proof that her husband took upon himself a commitment to support her children from a previous marriage, in case in event of a divorce. And once again, the shtar is written by Bezdin, not based on some possibilities, but based on what already took place. The hischaivus of mizonos was already set in stone, where the kinyan was achieved in such a way that the Baal could no longer rescind his commitment, his obligation. The shtar is only a shtar raya. And in the case of a shtar raya that's written by Bezdin, like this case of igros mazon, we can return the shtar to its owner, in this case the isha, so that she could collect bebo azman mizonos on behalf of her children from a previous marriage. And there's no reason to be choshesh for any sort of kinunya or any sort of piron, etc. The third shtar, the classification of shtar on this list, is shtare chalitza. Now here, my friends, we are moving from dine mamonos and financial obligations into a new realm of what we call iser v'heter. A woman who falls for Yibum can only marry if she gets Chalitza. She's called a Shomeres Yavam. Now, if the Chalitza took place in the presence of Bezdin, she'll need some sort of documentation to prove that she can marry anyone but a Kohen, of course, based on testimony that the Chalitza took place. And Bezdin is going to write this document called a Shtar Chalitza. Truth be told, that even in the case of a get, Beis Din has to supply her with what's called a pturin, which means some sort of a shtar, which testifies to the effect that she received her get. It's interesting that the Shulchan Aruch in Eben Ezer paskins that if Edim, if witnesses saw the chalitza that was done, that was performed in front of the Beis Din, they can write a get chalitza, which is the same as a shtar chalitza. There's no difference. And it's interesting that although here in our Mishnah we're talking about a Maisa Beis Din, the Shulchan Aruch extends that even without a Maisa Beis Din to Edim that saw the chalitza. Of course, the chalitza has to take place in front of the Beis Din, but the Edim witnessed the chalitza, they could write the shtar. Such a shtar, if lost, can be returned to the Yevama. She's now called a chalutza, so that she can get married to another man. Meunin. We know that there's a concept called Kedushei Ketana, which are only Kedushei Derabbanan. We're talking about a young girl. Her father is gone, and she can be married off by her mother or by her brothers to a Kedushei Miun, a kind of quasi-Kedushin. It's not a full-fledged Kedushin. It's a Kedushin which doesn't require a get. All it requires is miun. She has to make a declaration that she's not interested in living with this man. And then she's free. She needs just a shtar, which Beis Din will write for her, recording and testifying to the fact that there was miun and that she's allowed to get remarried. Now keep in mind, if her father is alive, we gave cases where her father's already gone, he could be Mekabel Kedushin on behalf of his daughter, even she's a Ketana, and that's Kedushei Torah. However, once the father dies, there's no possibility of Kedushei Torah in a Ketana. The Chachamim established that the Aim or the Achim could be Mekabel Kedushin on her behalf, and that would be Kedushei Derabbanan, otherwise known as Kedushei Miun. And the Ketana doesn't need a get, as we said, she just needs to be Mema'enes, and she makes a declaration in front of three people, Efshi Beploni Bali. I don't want to remain married to this individual. Now she's a Pnuya, she's allowed to get married, she just needs that shtar Meun, to prove that her marriage relationship has dissolved, if I can use that term. Now Rashi writes here, Dibra Maskel Miunin, that Ketani Yisoma Shisiya Ima Vachela Daita Yotza Mimenu Bimiun Vieina Tzricha Get Elamesle Shoshi Efshi Poni Vikosvin La Bezdin Shtar Shemina Bifnehem Lios La Edus Shemuteres Li Nose. And this Rashi is based on a Mishnah in Yevamos. The Mishnah records Beis Hillel and Beit Shammai. Beit Shammai say that Miyun has to take place in front of Beis Din. Beis Hillel allows and recognizes Miyun even outside the Beis Din. Here, the impression you get from Rashi is that the Miyun takes place in front of Beis Din. So what does Beis Hillel mean when they say Afilu Shalom Bifnei Beis Din? So the answer is that even though Beis Hillel also agree that you need the presence of Beis Din for a miyun, but nevertheless you don't need mumchim. And that's a sugya, the beginning of Sanhedrin, miunin bishlosha, Rashi explains, whatever Chazal were mesaken, they were mesaken ke'ein do raisa, and just like the Torah requires a get in front of a Beis Din, a chalitza in front of Beis Din, my mistake, and you need a Beis Din Shel Shlosha, so too, Miyun is a kind of Chalitza, it's a quasi or an extension of Chalitza that requires a Beis Din, but we don't need a Beis Din of Mumchim. However, there is another opinion, and that's the opinion of Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon. They say that Miyun can take place in the presence of two Edim, and there's no need for a Beis Din. The question is, do we paskin like them? And you find in Shulchan Aruch Eben Ezer, Hashnayim Shemino Bifneim Kosvin Lo Get Miun V'Kosvin Ba. Which means that according to Shulchan Aruch, the Miun is not a Maisa Beis Din like Chalitza. And Rashi here reflects Shaloke Hilchasa, according to the Shulchan Aruch, namely that Miun requires a Beis Din. The fourth category in this Mishnah is Shtarei Beirurin. We don't know what that means. The Gemara is going to take that up. V'chol Maisa Bezdin. Now the Mishnah gives you a more general, generic term of a Maisa Bezdin. There are other Shtaros that aren't mentioned here by name that also come under the same halacha, and were allowed, the finder is allowed to return the Shtar. And what's included under Kol Maisa Bezdin? So we've discussed already in previous Shiurim two shtaros that would fit this bill, fit this category, fit this document. One is called a shtar chaltasa, which means that the malva needs a shtar to collect from the nichsei halova. In other words, Bezdin will confirm that indeed the lova has not paid up this chov. They will therefore equip the malva with a shtar chaltasa, which is signed by Bezdin, to the effect that the malva has rights to collect the nichsei halova. And then there's something called shtar adrachta, when Bezdin could not find amongst the properties of the lova an appropriate property for the gvias hachova, the malva. They write a shtar for the malva that he's allowed to continue his inquiry, his search, his research, if you will, into the nichsei halova, the properties of halova, wherever they are on the face of the globe, such that if he does find nechasim that he can collect from, he will be allowed with the shtar to collect from the chov. And now the Mishnah tells us the general rule for all the above categories, all the shtaros. If a person finds any one of these shtaros, hareze yachzir, he can return them to the person whose name is written in the shtar, for whom the shtar was written, because these shtaros are above, they are not vulnerable to any sort of suspicion that they were written originally under this condition and then the conditions change, or the person rescinded his das, or so forth and so on, because these shtaros were written by Bezdin for the express purpose of being given to the person whose name is recorded in the shtar. And even at the end, if they would see that lo niskayim hadavar, let's say they prepare to get, a shtar chalitza on behalf of Shomeres Yavon, and at the end the Yavon backed out and he decided not to be chalitza, in such a case, Bezdin will not allow this shtar out of the shtar will be automatically invalidated. This shtar is only given over to the person, let's say in the case of a chalitza, to the chalutza, only after the chalitza was done, such that everything that's written in the shtar is already makuyam. The chalitza has been performed, and Bezdin knows that then and only then will we write the shtar chalitza to equip her, the former Yavama, the now Chalutza, with the ability to, and the permission to get remarried. Now, if, let's say, at the end, for whatever reason, Bezdin did not transfer the shtar over to the Chalutza, let's say in that case, but nevertheless, everything that's written in the shtar, namely that we saw the chalitza, so this shtar chalitza in any event is a reliable true shtar, the testimony written therein is correct, and therefore we could always, without any chashash, without any hesitation or inhibition, return the shtar chalitza to the isha, and there's no chashash piron like there was in other shtaros, etc., etc. Now, the Mishnah goes back to the real, let's say, classical cases of shtaros, which were not written by Bezdin, and even in that context, we can return certain shtaros in certain scenarios. Matzah bechafisa bedluskima, if a person finds any sort of a shtar that was locked up in a chafisa or a dluskima, these are various kinds of utensils where people would lock up valuables. The Gemara later on is going to explain what chafisa is, what dluskima is, but basically these are locked up in such a way that the shtar was written on behalf of someone who can give a simon that the shtar is in, I left it and I locked it up in such and such a kli, such and such a utensil that looks this way and that way. And again, the question here is exactly what is the simon here, the identifying mark Rashi, in the Divra Maskel HaRei, again, there are two Divra Maskels HaRei, but if you look on the second one, he says, Shakli Simon, Kshomer Abayim Bekli Kafakach Matsasi, Matsasa Osam. Rashi is learning at the very location of the Kli, I'm sorry, of the Shtar in the Kli, meaning the fact that he can guess where the finder found the Kli, that itself per se is the Simon. However, if you take a look at Tosfos on Daf Chaf Amid Beis, Divra Maskel Matzah, you will see that Tosfos maintains that the Simon here is not, although originally they understood is the fact that the Shtar is found in the Chafisa, they don't accept that. They rescind that original Pshat. They have a question because people, it seems to have been quite popular. It's a custom to place shtaris in a gluskama. So it's not a proof that it's his because he guessed that the shtar was found in a gluskama, but rather he has to give a simon on the gluskama itself. So it's not only that he tells the finder, "I know that you found it in such and such a gluskama, but I can tell you exactly where the Dluskuma, which Dluskuma you found it, because I can identify the Dluskuma with its various identifying marks." Tosfos asks, well, maybe the Dluskuma was borrowed, and this person can give you simonim on the Dluskuma simply because he had it in his possession for a certain period of time, but really doesn't prove a thing as to where the shtaros were placed, and the fact that he identifies this dluskuma might not be because it's his, and he hid a document in his dluskuma, but rather because he was a shoel at one point. So Tosfos answers that the way the Chacham made this takana, they in terms of Ashavas Aveda, they made it in such a way that we're not choshish for she'ela. I mean, a similar parallel we have in the fact that we can return an Aveda with a Siman Shein Muvok, which according to one day is only the Rabbanon. That's the way the Chachamim established it. They based themselves on certain roves and certain assumptions, and that's fine. The Shach has an interesting insight in Choshen Mishpat, and he writes that these Simonim that we're learning about here in our Mishnah would not help in terms of what we call Gviya Mimishubadim. Meaning, we will, as the Mishnah establishes, return the shtar with the simonim to the person whose name appears in the shtar. However, we'll give them a limited right to the shtar, meaning the shtar's power that he gains by holding on to the shtar is limited. He can collect from what's called b'nei chori, meaning from the lover's possessions, but not from mishubadim. As far as mishubadim is concerned, let's say properties that the lover owned and sold to others, this shtar will not have the power to go that far. We're always going to be afraid that maybe the lova told the malva the simonim, and that's why the malva was able to prove that this is his shtar that he lost, and there's some kanunya going on against the lekuchos between the malva and the lova. The Ktsos, however, who came much later than the Shach, he comments, based on the Shita Mekubetzes, that we're not choshesh for Kenunya. To say there's a Kenunya that the Lova is going to give the Malva Simonim, it's a little bit far-fetched, because he himself can take the Shtar, based on Simonim, and give it to someone else, V'litno Acherkach Lidea Malva. In other words, you're afraid that the Lov is setting it up in such a way by giving the Simon to the Malva get the Shtar. He'll gain possession of the Shtar, Bezenel award him the Shtar. But that's ridiculous, because forget about this whole Simonim business. If the Lova claims that it's his Shtar, and he has the Simonim in his back pocket, based on which Bezenel returned the Shtar, he can now take the Shtar and give it over to the Malva. So this whole inhibition about giving the Shtar over to the Malva, according to Shita Mekubetzes, makes no sense. And therefore the Malva could collect from Mishubadim. And that's out of the Sivas Paskins, that the Malva, in this case, can collect even from Mishubad. And that's the power of Simon. Fine. Now we have another case of Simon. He finds Tachrik Shel Shtaros. I mean, the Gemara is going to go into whole detail about how these various Shtaros were tied up together. Did you roll them together, or they were different separate rolled Shtaros, but they were put in the same kli, or they were tied together, etc., etc. And although the Mishnah doesn't specify which Shtaros we're talking about, but we're going to see later on that we're talking about three shtaros of Malvim that belong to the Malve, and Love Echad. Three Malvim and one Love. And therefore it's very possible and logical that all three shtaros belong to one person, meaning the Love. He paid up these three shtaros and he got back these three shtaros. However, let's say there were three shtaros of a Malve. There was only one Malve whose name appears in three documents, and there are three different Lovim. In that case, it makes sense that this Malve owns all three Shtaros. Because again, there's one Malve and three Lovim. Now, what about the case where there are three Shtaros which belong to one Malve and one Love? Here too, it makes sense to assume that all three shtaros belong to that one Malva or to that one Lova. Again, we're going to have to fight it out and see who has the simonim or who can prove that those shtaros belong to him. Then the Mishnah has a case of Oaguda Shel Shtaros, a bound group of many shtaros that were sort of laid out one on top of the other, and then there was a kricha biyachad. The Gemara later on is going to explain what's the difference between tachrich shel shtaros and aguda shel shtaros. They both sound identical. In any event, there in both these cases, there are two possible simonim. One simon would be the way it was tied up, and the other simon would be the number of shtaros that were found. But in any event, in all these cases, harei zeh yachzir, we can return the shtaros to the person who identifies the shtar with the siman that he gives. V'kama aguda shel shtaros, how many different documents have to be tied up together in order to qualify as an aguda shel shtaros, such that if the baal of these shtaros, let's say again there may have been three shtaros on the name of the malve, claims with this siman the aguda shel shtaros, shlosha kshurim zebazeh. You've got to have a minimum of three shtaros that are tied together. Because let's assume that someone finds these shtaros and he declares, because again, we have to get the loser together with the finder. And how do we link them together? The finder has to make a declaration, a public achrozah, that he found shtaros. Now, once he says shtaros, then that means a minimum of two shtaros, because he's using the grammatical plural. So now, the only way that we can even begin to entertain a simon here is with the number three. That's going to be the minimum. In any event, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Echad Halove Mishlosha Yachzir. If somebody found three shtaros, and they all belong to one love, in other words, this love borrowed money from three different people, and each one of the shtaros is written for each particular malve as yachzir, we can give him la lova. If the lova claims with a simon that he lost these shtaros, and why does he, the lova, hold on to these shtaros? Because he already paid up the chov, and when he returns the money to the respective malvim, each malve has to give him back the shtar, and then the shtaros fell and he lost them. So again, if we were to assume that the Lova had not yet paid up the Chov and they fell from the Malvim, then how could it be that all three Shtaros from three different Malvim had fallen in one place? You know, to find from three different Malvim, you know, these three Shtaros in one place, that's statistically almost impossible. However, if the Lova comes and identifies these shtaros, then we have every right to assume that the Lover paid back these three shtars. These three shtars were returned to him by the Malva, and then the Simon will be effective. Oh, but what if he finds Shlosha Halovim in a Echad? This is the reverse case, where there's one Lova and there's three Malvim. And in this case, if the Malva is the one who claims these three Shtaros, because although there are three different Lovim, there's one Malva, then when the Malva claims these three Shtaros, and he says these are outstanding Shtaros, debts that are outstanding that haven't been paid up, he's believed if he can give a Simon. Now, what happens if the three Shtaros that were found were written by one scribe, the Ksav Yad of the three Shtaros is absolutely identical, clearly indicating that it was written by one Sofer? Then perhaps we should be afraid that it was the Sofer who lost these Shtaros. And although the Sofer prepared these Shtaros for the Lover, or for three different Lovim, maybe they were never actually given to the Lover, and therefore the Simon should not be meaningful. And that's going to be the case that's discussed in the Gemara. The Mishnah continues, Motza Shtar Bein Shtarosov. He finds a Shtar amongst his belongings, which was written for someone else, and Eina Yedea Mativo. So, for example, let's say Reuven finds a shtar, and the names written on the shtar are Shimon and Levi. I mean, Shimon is the Malva, and Levi is the Lova. And he's confused. Eina Yedea Mativo. Why is he holding on to the shtar? He doesn't remember. Who gave it to him? Did the Lova give it to him in custody, so to speak, as a mafkid gives his possession to a shomer, which means that the Lova already paid up the chov? Or is it possible in the reverse, that the Malva is holding on to the shtar, and he gave it to, let's say, Shimon, the Malva gave it to Reuven, a shomer, and asked him to hold on to the shtar? So we don't know. The person who's holding the shtar is very confused. He doesn't know if this was a shtar parua, and it belongs to the Lova, or it's a shtar she'eno parua, and it belongs to the Malva. It's also possible that the Lova paid part of the chov that's written in the shtar. Let's say the loan was for 100, he paid already 50. And since he didn't pay the other 50, it's not fair to return the shtar to the Lova. The Malva still wants the shtar. On the other hand, how can you give the shtar to the Malva? The Malva says 50, he's going to collect the full 50. So basically, the finder is confused. Is Yehi Munach Ad Sheyovo Elio? In this case, the shomer, if you will, should not return to the shtar, neither to the Malva nor to the Lova. He's simply confused. The Rashba writes that even if both the Malva and the Lova would admit together, would join in claiming that the shtar belongs to the Malva, to the Lova, if we give the shtar to the Malva, for example, the Rashba claims we have a chashash of kinunya, of hefsed lekuchos. The Rush, on the other hand, is not impressed by this. He says it's not logical that we should be choshish for kinunya, or, for example, another possibility that maybe the shtar was written in advance, assuming, anticipating that there would be a matan mos, and there wasn't a matan mos. There was never a loan that was extended by the Malva. And the Rush insists that that's only relevant to a shtar that fell and was found in a public place. It has a reisa in it. And the fact that the owner of the shtar was not careful about the shtar, that indicates that, you know, maybe the shtar is not valid. We should be choshesh all types of suspicions. But here in our case of the Mishnah, the shtar was given over to a third party, to Reuven, as a shomer. It was mufkad biyado. There's no reisa. Again, the nifkad himself is the problem. You know, he forgot who actually gave him the shtar. And therefore, says the Rosh, if both are moda, that the shtar belongs to either the malva or the lova, that's what he should do, this nifkad, this shomer. He should give it to the malva or the lova. That's the Rosh. And finally, the Mishnah concludes by saying the following, im yesh imoem simponos. Supposing amongst his shtaros, he finds a simpon. A simpon is a shovar, meaning a receipt. And this shovar is coming to be mavatal a shtar. This, let's say, shtar milva, but this shovar is saying that shtar milva was already paid up. And now, let's say the malva looks amongst his shtaros, all shtaros that are valid and active, allowing him to collect chovos, and he finds, lo and behold, a shovar. Now, this shovar is written in his own handwriting. He finds his own handwriting on a shtar that testifies to the fact that the lova paid up the chov. He still is holding on to the shtar chov for this very halvah. So he doesn't know exactly what to do with the shtar, because it's quite possible that the lova actually paid up the shtar, the chov, as testified by the simpon, by the shovar, and yet, for some reason, the lova didn't get the shovar into his hands. It's also possible, on the other hand, that although the malva prepared the shovar for in advance, in event that the lova, or when the lova would pay up the shtar, the chov, he didn't pay up the chov. So the din in this case, says the Mishnah, is yase mashe bisimponos. In other words, whatever it says in the simpon, that's what he, the malva, should uphold. And although the shtar chov is also in his hands, we're going to assume based on the simpon that it's parua, it's becheskes parua, and the malva should not collect that chov. He should take that shtar milva and get rid of it, so to speak. Again, even though the question is, why is this shtar simpon, why is this shovar in the hands of the malva, not in the hands of the lova, we have to assume, we have to at least recognize the possibility that the lova did not receive a receipt, right, a shovar from the malva. He trusted the malva, and perhaps he was hoping and expecting that the malva would, either tomorrow or the day after, would supply him with a shovar. The Gemara later on is going to analyze this din and going to limit its scope and its application to a case where the shtar that on it has a shovar is found amongst ripped up shtaros. Which means that whenever the malva has a shtar that is no longer valid, he rips it up. And here he finds a shovar that's not ripped up, which lends credence to the argument that the shovar is still valid, and in fact the lova did pay up the chov, just that the malva was, at least on a temporary basis, entrusted with the shtar. Now the Gemara wants to clarify, what is shtari birurim? My shtari birurim, hacha, here in Bavel Tirgumu, they interpreted it with shtari ta'anasa. The shtar birur is what we call a record. You know, sometimes in the courts, even to this day, there is a person typing for the records, the arguments and the claims and counterclaims of the various litigants. And back in the day, Chazal established what we call Sofrei Adayonim. These were the scribes who were in charge of recording documents, and they would record on behalf of the Dayanim the various claims and the counterclaims of the litigants. And once a claim was recorded, the particular Baldin who made that claim could no longer rescind his claim. And that's what we have here in the case of Bavel. Now, the Shita Mugbetzis adds another point, that these Sofrei HaDayanim, when they record the Tainos, the Mishnah says at the end of Bava Basra, Ein Kosvin Shtar Birurim Ela Midas Shnehem. It means that this is not something that goes on privately. You know, the scribes and the Dayanim of the Dayanim are taking down, you know, evidence that is crystal clear, that is objective. Both litigants are there. The claims and counterclaims are validated, and they're recorded for all posterity in an irreversible way on the Shtari Tanosa, the Shtari Biruri. That's how we interpret our Mishnah in Bavel. Rabbi Yirmiya was in Eretz Yisrael, Amar. He says that there's another meaning to Shtari Birurim, and this is based on a din in the third parak of Sanhedrin, which is called Zeborer, Zavla, which means that in order to form the makeup of the court, then you have two litigants, the Tovea and the Nitba, right, the plaintiff and the defendant, and each one chooses one Dayan. The Dayan of his choice, which judge he would like to serve on the case. That's called Zeborolo Dayan Echad v'Zeborolo Dayan Echad. Now, as far as the third, because every bezin has to be made up of three in Dini Mominus, they, the two litigants, the Tovea and the Nitva, agree on a third Dayan. And that's called Shtare Birurim. The Shtare Birurim is a document that attests to the fact that these are the three Dayanim that were chosen by the Bali Dinim for this particular litigation, for this case. Now, on the side, I would like to point out that there's a Machlokas Rishonim as to this halacha of Breiras HaDayanim. According to one Shita, once the Breiras HaDayanim was recorded on a shtar, that itself is the finale. That's the latest time after which it's impossible for either of the Bali Dinim to change and to decide this is not the Beis Din that will judge them. And the writing of the shtar Birurim, according to this opinion of Rishonim, is tantamount to what we call kanu miyado. Whenever there's a commitment on the part of someone, whoever that someone is, that is crystallized and clinched by a kinyan usually means a kinyan sudar, that clincher of the kinyan makes it impossible to reverse, to have a change of heart. That's why this shtar birurim, in order to indicate a full-fledged kinyan and a commitment which is irreversible, irretractable, has to be written midas shneihem. Because once the dayanim have been chosen and the shtar has been written, there's no way back. However, there's another opinion in the Rishonim, which you'll see here in Shita Mekubetzes. They're of the opinion that even after the Shtar Birurim was written and signed, nevertheless, up until the point of Gemar Din, and this is a pretty radical Shita, the litigants can decide, either one of them can decide, I want out. This is not going to be my Beis Din. In other words, once there's a Gemar Din, and here's where according to this Shita Mekubetzes, the Shtari Birurim come into play. After the Gemar Din, if one of the dayanim will say, well, one of the litigants, excuse me, will claim, I didn't decide, I didn't choose on these dayanim, that the shtar serves the purpose to disprove his argument, to undermine his argument, because once the shtar birurim was signed, then we know for a fact, this shtar birurim testifies to the fact that both litigants accepted these dayanim. So don't tell me after the Gemara din, start screaming and yelling, hey, these weren't my judges. Now, in the Hebrew here, he writes, Yesh sovrim sha'achar shetonu bifneim ein yecholim lachzor behem, afal pishalo kosvu velo konu miyodo. Here's a third sheet, and this is the polar extreme, that the litigants cannot be chozer once they already placed or presented their arguments and their claims in front of these three dayanim, even though nothing's been written, nothing, no kinyan has been effectuated, they cannot decide, well, these are not my dayanim. Once they began their tainus, once they began presenting their arguments in front of these dayanim, that's tantamount, al-pidin, to k'mo shekvar poschu bedino. They've already begun the judgment. The judgment is kicked off, is begun, al-pidin, with the tainus that are put forth in front of these three dayanim. And this opinion has it that once the din started, and again the kickoff of the din is the tainus, then you cannot claim I want to go to a different bezdin. It's as if there was a kinyan on these dayanim to judge them. Now the Mishnah says that kol maisa bezdin areze yachzir. Any shtar that's found that is a maisa bezdin, we can return it. And here we have a story that took place in the bezdin of Huna. We've discussed this sugya in the past. This is a repeat. So I might be moving a little bit faster than usual. Hahugita dishtakach beidina de Rav Huna. They found a get that was already mekuyam and had a henpeik on it. Bezdin had already verified the authenticity of the signatures, and they put their stempel, their notarized seal on it. That's called a henpeik. And this shtar, this get, was found in the bezdin of Rav Huna. And when the get was brought in front of Bezdin for the purpose of kiyum, in order to establish, as we said before, the authenticity of the signatures, now somebody who had brought this get dropped the get. They don't know exactly who it was. A person comes in front of the Bezdin. He claims that he was the one who was holding the get and drops the get. And he dropped the get, inadvertently dropped the get. And he claims that the Baal, whose name is written in the get, and his wife's name is written in the get, had appointed him as a shliach to bring this get to the Isha. And now he's demanding that the get be returned to him so that he can indeed deliver it to the Isha. And all this is in Rashi, Dibra Maschil, De Ishtakach, which you'll see on the last line of Daf Chof Omer Aleph. HaShliach Avio Omer Mimeni Nofa. Now, what was unique about this shtar and Rav Puna's refusal to return the shtar to the shliach? Davi ksiv bei, every get has to have a makom testifying to where the get was written. This particular case, it says b'shvire masa, the al rochis nara, in a particular city, the name of which is Shvire, that banks on the river of Rochis. Omer Rav Huna. So Rav Huna says, Afalpi, even though that in this city of Shvire, as far as we can tell, there's no one else in the city that has the same name as the name of the person that's written in the get. And nevertheless, here on the top of Chof Amid Beis, Chayshinon L'Shnei Shviri. In this Shviri, there's no other Baal and Isha with those names, but maybe there's another city somewhere on the face of the globe that has this name Shviri. Again, I personally did a word search here in Google for Shviri. I didn't find any city the name Shviri. But I guess back in the day, maybe Shviri was a common name. And therefore, Rav Huna was worried about the following scenario, the following possibility, that maybe in a different city by the same name, Shviri, which may be halfway across the map, across the globe, there is, in fact, another person, another Jew, who has the same first name, Omali Rav Chizdo L'Rabba. Now, Rabba is a Talmud of Rav Huna. And in this case, I guess Rav Chizdo was wondering about this very extreme position of Rav Huna to worry about another city with the same name, and maybe there's another Baal and Isha with those same names in that fictitious city, which we don't even know exists. Poke the Ayin Bidavar, we'll add the word Bidavar, meaning go check out this matter, Dili Urta, because this evening, Boila Rav Huna Minach, Rav Huna is going to ask for your opinion whether you second his motion on this Horah. Nofak, Rabba went out, Duck, very famous phrase in the Talmud, he checked out in the various Mishnayos, in the various Brises, he did his research, he Ashkach, and he found a Mishnah which would indicate that Rav Huna's Horah was incorrect. Asnan, it says in the Mishnah that if somebody finds Kol Maisa Bezdin, our Mishnah, any shtar that was written by Bezdin, or it was written by someone else but it was Mekuyim in Bezdin, is Hareza Yachzir. We can return such a shtar to the person for whom this shtar was written. And since there was a Kiyum on this shtar in Bezdin, we shouldn't be choshesh that maybe the person who wrote the shtar had a second thought, a change of heart, and he never delivered the shtar. And it would seem clear from the Mishnah that since in this city in which the shtar was written, there was no other person with the same name, as far as we know, the name that's written in the shtar, we're not going to be choshesh for another city somewhere that's out there. All we need to know is that it's Lo Huchzok Shnei Yosef and Shimon Be'ir. So to suspect that in a case of a shtar that had a Maisa Bezdin, in this case it was a Kiyum on the Get, that maybe this shtar belongs to some other person with the same name in a city which has the identical name as this one, that's not so. Amalei Rav Amram L'Rabba, Heichi Poshet Mar Isura Mimamona. If you take a look, says Rav Amram, carefully at the Mishnah, the list of the Mishnah, all the stars in the Mishnah unanimously have one common thread. They're all dealing with Dinei Mamonos. And okay, in Dinei Mamonos, we don't have to suspect that there's another person in another city, blah, blah, blah. But here, we're dealing with a much more severe halacha. We're not dealing with some sort of Chumra Derabanan here, but we're dealing with a Chashash D'Oraisa. Maybe when it comes to Dini Mominus, we're not going to, the Rabbanan are not going to be machbir and worry about the possibility, invent the possibility of two cities with the same name, Shvili. But as far as get is concerned, you're going to return this get to the Shliach, and you're dealing with an Isra Eshashish. You're going to be matir and Eshashish when this get is delivered by the Shliach to the Isha. Amalei, Rabba was very upset with Rav Amram, and in a sense, accusing Rav Amram of not reading this Mishnah carefully. Tarda, maybe Tarda means you were half asleep or something like that. Very, very, a very strict, harsh language. Shtore Chalitza Umiyunin Tnan. The Mishnah, in fact, has two. So Shtari Chalitza and Shtari Miyun are not Dini Mominus. We're talking about Isra Vehetu. We're talking about being Matir a Chalitza, who's really a Shomer's Yovim, if not for the Shtar. The Shtar testifies that she's allowed to get married. According to one day in Yevamos, we're talking about an Iser Erva, Mamish. A Yevam L'Shuk is an Iser Erva, not just even a regular Lav. Okay, Miun, in the case of Kedusha Ketana, that's only Kedusha D'Rabbanan, but nevertheless, we're not limiting ourselves to Dini Mominus. This is not a special Kula. This really sets the tide and the tone for returning a shtar if you find it. We're not going to worry about two shviris. Now, the Gemara ends with a story which is a little bit shocking here. Poka Arza de Bei Rav, the pillar that held up the Beis Medrash, somehow collapsed. Now, I don't know exactly the repercussions here. I'm not sure if anyone got hurt. It sounds like a pretty dangerous situation. I don't know. And Rav Amram, that's Mar Omar, he declared Mishum Latai Dide Poka, meaning this phenomenon is supernatural, you know, it comes from God. It's a divine way of saying that Hashem is angry about the way you, Rabbah, were Megadef me, you know, by calling me Tarda. Now again, I said Tarda means, you know, that you were half asleep, but in truth, I'm afraid to tell you this, guys, but Rashi in Masechta Krisa says the word Tarda means a shote. I mean, that's a pretty, pretty heavy insult. In any event, the Gemara goes on to say, Umarom, a rabbi says, Mishum latai di dipaka, that this was the way of Hashem defending my kavod, because you went to embarrass me in the Beis Medrash by telling me that I have no proof from the Mishnah. Anyway, you see, Rabosai, that this was serious business here, these dinu dvarim between Amorohim, and to bring a raya from a Mishnah, it's not dvarim shel mabakach. Now, in defense of Rav Amram, we could suggest the following. Rav Amram was not lazy or bored, or it wasn't an idiosyncrasy that he missed the punchline of this Mishnah. No. There are three categories. There's a category in Halacha called Dini Mominus, clearly. There's a category called Dinei Iser Veheter. And then there's a third category called Arayos. And it's very possible that we can make an equation between the strictures and the demands of evidence with regard to Dinei Mominus and those of Dinei Iser Veheter. So when it comes to something like Chalitza, according to Rav Amram, we're dealing with Iser Veheter. When it comes to Get, Rav Amram says that's a different kind of category, that's much more chomer, that's Eishes Ish. And, for example, the sugya at the end of Yevamos makes a distinction between Eishes Ish and Chalitza, clearly. For example, in the case where a woman's husband fell into Mayim Shein Lahem Sof, clearly there's a rov that he died, and yet we're not allowed to be matir his wife. She remains an aguna. In the case of Chalitza, the Gemara establishes that Rov Noshim is Arbos V'Yoldos, and therefore we can rely on Rov as far as Chalitza is concerned. For example, in Miun, is Aloch is Ketana She'igil Echlal Shenoseh Chazoka She'viyah Simonim, and well, that's all based on Rov. In other words, whereas Rabbah L'shitoso equates Gittin with Chalitza and Miun, and just like in Gittin, we should be worried about Shnei Shviri, two cities with the same name, if we're worried about them in the case of Chalitza. And therefore, since the Mishnah is not worried about Shnei Shviri in the case of Chalitza, ipso facto, there's no need to worry about Shnei Shviri in the case of Get. And Rav Amram didn't accept that. So again, whether the status of Chalitza and Shomer Yovam is that of Isurim, Shari Surim, or whether it has the status of Erva and Eishes Ish, again, that might be totally, this is my own opinion, in the Machlokas Rav and Shmuel about whether or not Kedushin Tovsin be Yavam L'shuk, whether or not she has the din of an Erva. Whether we view a Shomer Yovam as if she were an Eishes Ish, meaning the Zika that she has to the Yovam is Ishus Mamish. The Mishnah says, Motzach Chafisa o Bidluskima. The Gemara says, My Chafisa o Rabba Barbachana Chemas Ktana. This is a small jug, or perhaps it's made of skins, of animal skins. So it's a kind of a flask, if you will. You've seen them, you know, especially in the pictures of the old times. Usually they would keep wine in these little pouches. My dluskima, Amar Abba Bar Shmuel, tlika disavi. Savi are the older people, and they used to classically walk around with a kind of a sock, some sort of a bag, you know, like a pocketbook of some sort. That's where they could, you know, they could put all, any sort of little utensils that they needed as they carried around, you know, kli tashmisha, maybe a mirror, maybe a fork and a knife and a spoon. And these were all kinds of pocketbooks that they used, the elderly, in order to make sure they didn't have to look for things when they needed them. The Mishnah says that Tachris shel shtaros or agudah shel shtaros. Tana Rabbanan the Braisa says, "Kama hu? What's the minimum number? B'tachris shel shtaros." That defines a tachris shel shtaros shlosha kruchim zebazeh. You've got to have three shtaros that are wrapped up or wound up together. That's the siman that the person who claims that the shtar is his offers to identify these shtaros as his. So in other words, the one who finds the shtaros, he gives a hachrozi, yells out and screams, "Shtaros matzasi, I found shtaros." And the one who lost these shtaros and claims they're mine, he says there were three shtaros that you found that were wound up together, zebazeh, kruchim heim zebazeh. And again, how would the Ma'abid know that that's what the finder found when he said shtaros matzasi? The very fact that he lost these three shtaros that were kruchim biyachin, and that's exactly what the finder finds, that's a siman, and we can return to him the shtaros. V'kama yaguda shel shtaros. So we have the tachrik shel shtaros, which is three. The aguda shel shtaros is also three, shlosha, but they kshurim zebazeh. In other words, they're three round up shtaros. Each one is round up on its own. You know, like if you ever buy a piece of art, it doesn't mean that it's worth anything, but they wind it up, right? They create a glalil, a glilon out of it. And he finds three of those. That's called an aguda shel shtaros. The Gemara says, Shma minosh, we derive from this that kesher simon, meaning in the case of agudah shel shtaros, the one who's claiming this as his is telling you exactly how these three shtaros were bound together. What we call in Hebrew the shtzuras hakesher. He can identify exactly the nature of the knot that ties up these three shtaros. That's his simon. And we are machzir the shtaros based on that simon of the kesher. Now, Rabosai, what I can't tell you right now, I'm hoping I'll be able to tell you this, whether or not that kind of a simon of the Tzuras HaKesher is a simon muvak or not a simon muvak. In other words, in the first case, which we called a tachrich shel shtaros, which means he identifies three shtaros that are bound to, that are wound together, right, winding them together as one galil, that would sound like a simon muvok. But I'm not sure in the case of agudah shel shtaros, where he identifies the nature of the kesher, is that considered a simon muvok? Now later on, we're going to have Tosfos and the Rush. They claim that according to the Maskonas HaSugi, which we didn't get up to, even Minyan is a Simon. Forget about the Tzuras HaKesher, but if the claim, the one who's claiming the Shtaros says you found three Shtaros, that itself, the fact that he, the claimer, can tell you that you found three Shtaros in one place, that itself is a Simon. And forget about the Kricha, and forget about the Tzuras HaKesher, even if they weren't kruchim together, the simon is the minyan. And then the Gemara wants to suggest that this braisa is not a proof to establish that kesher is considered a simon. And why is that so? Da'atani, we have already a limud, a derivation from Rab Chiya. Rab Chiya has this braisa, which explains what agudah shel shtaros is, shlosha kruchim zebazeh. In other words, the simon that the ma'abed, the loser, claims, again, I hate to use the word loser, it sounds like he's a loser, but I mean the one who claims he lost them, we'll call them ma'abed from now on, is that three shtaros were kruchim yachad. In other words, it's quite common for people when they want to create this group of shtaros together, what they do is, instead of, you know, flattening them all out and winding them all as if they were one shtar, because the length, you know, the top and the bottom of the shtar are positioned equally on all three shtaros, what they really do is they just are megalgel or golel each star unto itself, and then they take these shtaros and they tie them together and put them in one kricha, into one bundle. Now, when a person comes and gives the siman that what you found was shlosha shtaros kruchim biyachad, that itself is a siman, a proof that he dropped these shtaros, and we're going to give it to him with that alone. In other words, the siman here is not necessarily the tzuras hakesher, as we said before, in the case of the aguda shel shtaros, but just the very fact that he can identify your find as three shtaros, each one was rolled up, of course, that were connected together in one bundle. But we don't know about kesher. Now, the Gemara at this point clearly indicates that the fact that he, the Ma'abe, can identify that you found three shtaros, each one was karuch, that's an even better siman than kesher, than tzuras hakesher. And that's clear from the Braisa of Reb Chiya. The Gemara is upset about this because ihachi, if it's true that aguro shel shtaros means three shtaros that are kruchim biyachad, and it has nothing to do with kshurim biyachad, it has nothing to do with the way they were tied, is hainu tachrich shel shtaros. We're going back to the case in the mission of tachrich shel shtaros. What's the difference between tachrich shel shtaros and aguda shel shtaros? And the Gemara says the following: tachrich is called chad v'chad barosha dechavre, aguda deramo adode ukruchos. That the case of a tachrich, it means each one of the shtaros is karuch berosha dechavrei, which means on the top part of the shtar of the second one. In other words, it's not that each shtar is exactly placed length, width and length on the shtar below it, but in a sense you've created like this long glil of three shtaros. Whereas the agudishal shtaros is where he places one on top of the other, exactly fit, and the orech of one star is on top of the orech of the next star, etc., etc. And that's how he rolled them together. So the different ways of rolling together these staros and making it into a tachrich or an aguda, and respectively that's tachrich and that's aguda. The Gemara now wants to know, why is it that in every discussion that we've had about tachrich or aguda and the simonim, it's always a minimum of three staros? That seems to be the minimum, the magic number here. And the Gemara says that all depends by machris. What exactly does the finder declare when he finds a tachrich shel shtaros and aguda shel shtaros? If he is machris minyan, you know, he declares, I found three shtaros, and now the ma'abid comes along and he says, well, you found them kruchim, either this way or that way, as a tachrich, as an aguda, etc., etc., is my iria tlosa. If that be the case, then why does the Mishnah and the Braisa stipulate that the finder found three shtaros? Meaning, if the siman is the tachrich or the aguda, then afilu trei nami, even if the finder found only two shtaros, which clearly would not be a siman minyan, but the siman is the kricha or the aguda. And the fact that he only found two shtaros, that should be sufficient. And the Ma'abi gives the siman that these two shtaros was kruchim biyachad in this way and that way. So why does the Mishnah stipulate three shtaros? Ella, but rather, ki the Omer Ravina in Elu Mitzias, we'll get to it in five bladim, it's Hashem, if somebody finds three matbeos, three coins, zel gabi zeh, so he doesn't notify the public that I found three matbeos, but rather he says, tiva machris. He says, I found coins. He doesn't tell you how many he found. And then the Ma'abed gives you the siman of how many there were. Hokinami here too, shtore machris. The finder will just declare that he found documents. He doesn't tell you exactly how many documents he found. And the Ma'abed will come along and say, well, there were three documents that were kruchim zebas, and then we could return it to him. So therefore, the Mishnah is very meticulous and demanding of three shtaros, and only in the case where you find three shtaros, then you return them to the Ma'abi, the one who's claiming with the Simon. If he only finds two Shtaros, and the Hakraza was Shtaros Matzasi, and a person says, well, there are two Shtaros, that's not a Simon at all, because again, as we mentioned earlier, Ein Miut Rabim El Shnayim, it's the least, the smallest number that could fit into the plural is two, and we have no reason to ascertain that he, the claimant who puts forward the Simon of two Shtaros, is really indeed the one who lost these Shtaros. So again, as far as the final maskon of the sugi is concerned, we see a kind of integration here between the element of minyan. In other words, you found Shtaros, I know that you found three Shtaros. And number two, the fact that these three Shtaros were kruchim, and that would make them into a tachrich shel shlosha, or agudim, and that would make them into an aguda shel shlosha. It seems that the simon here is a sum total, an aggregate, if you will, of A plus B, two different variables. And this is what incurs the kind of wrath, if you will, the Tosa Rush, diramaskel shmamino. Why do you need A plus B? If the simon of minyan is a simon, if the simon of kruchim is a simon, each one independent should be a simon. After all, the Gemara later on, Chav Gimel and Beis, is going to clarify and establish that minyan is a simon and kricha is a simon. Why does Rashi insist that we need both A plus B? And here we have a marshal who tries to answer the question, the objection of the Tosus or Rush, and say that here we need two simonim, because if he offers one simon and he doesn't know the second simon, then he's creating a reusa on his very claim that he is the loser, the one who lost these shtaros. Because it's very strange. If indeed he dropped these shtaros, how is it possible shelo yotza min ha-simon shel minyan o shel kricha? Is it that he couldn't offer both simonim? Say, no, chinami, minyan itself would be a simon if there were no other obvious distinguishing marks. Kricha or aguda would be a simon if there was no obvious minyan. But if you have the metzias of something that was found, where the reality is that it has both these unique features, then we should anticipate that he should offer both elements as a simon. How could he know only one and not the other? And that creates a reusa. And it's also possible to say that this reusa applies with regard to gittin. I'm not sure it would apply in general Ashavas Aveda. And the Rush adds another possibility. He says, Be'emes maspik gam simon shel minyan gam simon shel kricha ve'echem mishneim havi simon, that maybe l'maskana, one of the two, either minyan or kricha, would serve as a valid simon. U'lefichach, why does he say, no ketshneim l'amdenu shegam ha-kricha ve'gam ha-minyan u'sina, that either one of these, in and of themselves, independent, would be and qualify as a simon. Rav Shimon Gamliel omer, echad alove mishlosha, yachzil alove. If there are three shtaros that are found from one love, which means that even though there are many malvim, the logic compels us to assume that the love took back these shtaros when he paid up each of the three respective malvim. The isal kedaitach de malvin minhu, if you would raise the possibility that these shtaros fell from the three malvim, we'll call them Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, and in fact the love hasn't paid up either one of them, is my boy Gabi Adodi. How is it possible that we found these three shtaros together? Echad Eitzel Chaver, meaning one shtar next to the other. How could it be that from three different malvim, all of which who dropped the shtar, but it really is their shtar, the malvim, the chov is still outstanding, they all dropped it in one place? So the Gemara asks, Dilma, perhaps, when could you have three shtaros and three different malvim together? Is likuyuminu azli? Maybe these three malvim were on the way together to Beis Din. Each one wanted to be mekayim the shtar with the chasimus edim on the shtaros, so that they would achieve and succeed in getting from the from the Sofri Adayonim, a hen peg, each one respectively on his shtar, to prove that his shtar is in fact authentic. And guess what? On the way to Beis Din, they gave the shtaros into the hands of one person, and he, the so-called Nifkad, the Shomer, dropped all these three shtaros in one fell swoop. And therefore, there is no proof here that these fell from the hand of the Lova. Again, there's one Lova. He's claiming he paid up all these three shtaros, and that's why they returned to him. How? For what other reason did you find the three shtaros together? No. These shtaros belong to the Malvin, and the Lova owes each one of these three Malvin. Why did they drop together? How did that happen? They were all on the way to Beis Din. They took the same road, the same journey to Beis Din, in order to be Mekayim the Shtar and get a henpeg from Beis Din, and that's where they dropped the Shtaros, or maybe they deposited the Shtaros in the hands of a certain person who lost the Shtaros subsequently. So on that kasha, we have a teretz of the Gemara. The Gemara says that the Mekayim, that our Shtaros that were found were already Mekuyam. There was a henpeg on each one of the Shtaros. It's impossible to say and to present the assumption that perhaps the Malvim were on the way to Beis Din to achieve the henpeg, because if that would be the case and they all dropped their shtaros off in the hands of one person on the way to henpeg, why is it that the three shtaros, each one has a henpeg on it? The Gemara comes back and asks another kasha. Dilma miyada disafra nafil. Maybe these shtaros fell from the hands of the Sofer HaDayonim himself. After he wrote a henpeg on each one of the shtaros, he didn't get a chance to return it to the Malvim, each Malva respectively. He himself, the Sofer, dropped these three shtaros in one place. And that's why we find three shtaros, the three different Malvim in one place, but it was the Malvim that dropped the shtaros. The Gemara answers, no, that's not a logical possibility. Lo mashi inish kiyume biyoda de safra. A Malve who comes into Beis Din to achieve his goal, namely to have a henpeg on the shtar, to be mekayim the shtar, he doesn't leave it in the hands of the Sofer Dayonim. You know, he's not going to go take a lunch break, go catch in the matinee, and then come back to Beis Din. No, he's going to wait there patiently and anxiously to receive his shtar back. There's a lot at stake over here. So immediately after the henpeg is established on the shtar, he takes the shtar back. And if that be the case, then it's almost impossible to assume that these three shtaros were lost by the sofer. And therefore, we're going to assume that these shtaros were lost by the lover. Kind of the Gemara is that you find three shtaros in one place and they each had a henpeg on it, then it's impossible to assume that three Malvim dropped their shtaros in the same place. They weren't on the way to Beis Din. They were on the way out of Beis Din. It's impossible that the Sofer dropped them, because they would have taken the shtaros back immediately. Therefore, we assume that these shtaros were dropped by the Lova. He indeed paid all these three chovos respectively, and therefore, with the Simon, we return these three shtaros to the Lova. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel continues in our Mishnah, Shlosha Shalovu Mi'echad Yachzir Lamalva. And the Gemara now is going to analyze and explain the Svara of Shimon Gamliel. How does he know that these three shtaros fell from the Malva? And the case is that three lovim barred from one Malva. The Isal Kedaitoch, if you're going to entertain the possibility, to lovim ninhu, that these three shtaros were paid up and they belonged and were dropped by three lovim respectively. After each one got his shtar returned to when he repaid the loan, my bo gabi adodi. Why would three lovim gather together as a chabura and have lost the shtar, or have deposited the shtar in the hands of somebody? So the Gemara is not happy with this. The Gemara asks, Dilma limichtavinu azle. Perhaps these three lovim were on their way together to the sofer to ask the sofer to write, on behalf of each one of them, a shtar, that afterwards, if they would come to Beis Din to or to the Malva to borrow more money. They already each one have their shtaros prepared. So this is a loan after a loan. As far as the first loan is concerned, they paid up the first loan. And since each one paid up the loan, they got back the shtar, each one respectively from Mr. Malva. We'll call him Reuven. But now each one goes back to the sofer. Again, we're assuming that there's one sofer in town. And all these three lovim go back to the sofer, asking him to prepare a replacement shtar. The first shtar is called Nimchal Shibuda. It cannot be reused. They need now to pay Sofer Dedaini. They have to pay him some money to rewrite a shtar, which will be in their hands, each one respectively, in their hands in order to go back to the Malva in event that they need another halva. It's very common for a person who pays up his halva to somewhere down the line in the future come back to the same Malva and if need be ask him for a second halva. The sofer, from his point, prepared these three shtaros. He hasn't yet had the opportunity to give them to each one of the three lovim. And in the meantime, naflu miyado. In other words, they deposit their shtaros, each one respectively, in the hands of the sofer, and ask him to sort of duplicate those shtaros. So here we have three lovim, all of whom are pouncing upon or gravitating to one particular sofer, and the sofer is receiving their shtaros respectively. All those shtaros were parua, and he's rewriting and recreating a new shtar to replace each one of these three. So it's very possible that, now I'm reading Rashi again, and I'm getting the impression that according to Rashi, what happened was that the sofer, not the way I said it, that these three lovim respectively gave their old shtaros, they used up shtaros to the sofer and he dropped them, but rather the sofer has prepared these three shtaros, but before he was able, he had the opportunity to give each one of the lovim respectively their shtar, he dropped these shtaros. And this, in the Gemara's presentation, is the possibility that these three shtaros, that's Gemara's kasha, which belong to three different lovim, were lost together. By whom? By the sofer. So the Gemara answers, no. Dechsive bitlos yidei safri. Our case in our Mishnah is that the shtaros were written by three different sofrim, and we can tell that from the Ksav Yad, you know, it's from the particular unique way that each sofer writes. Each one has his own signature, so to speak. Each shtar was written by a different sofer. Then it's impossible to say that it was the sofer who dropped these three shtars that belonged to three different lovim. So again, we ask the question, how is it possible that they fell together? It must be that they fell from the Malva. And therefore, the Mishnah establishes that Rav Shimon Gamliel establishes that we give it back to the Malva. The Gemara asks another kasha. Vidilma l'kiyu minu azli, that the lovim were on their way to Beis Din to be mekayim the chasimas edim on the shtaros, so that if they decide to borrow money again from the malva, they'll be able to give the malva a shtar mekuyim. The malva will be very thrilled to offer a loan in matmos in exchange of a shtar milva that has a henpek on it. So these lovim were on the way to get a henpek on their shtar. Now, if that be the case, it's possible that on their way to Beis Din, they, on a temporary basis, deposited their shtaros, each one of these lovim, respectively, in the hands of someone. And perhaps that someone, who may be one of the lovim, dropped these three shtaros in one fell swoop. So again, it's still possible that the halva never took place, because again, this was all in the pre-matmos, the pre-halva state, where the lovim were on their way to Beis Din to get a henpek. And therefore, the Gemara again objects, why is it that Rav Shimon Gamliel returns these three shtaros to the Malva, giving him, equipping him with the weapon to be over these from these three lovim? And the Gemara answers that that's not a logical assumption. Why? Malve mekayim shtare, lova lo mekayim shtare. And this is something that intuitively we sensed, even when we read the Gemara's Havamina here. Why would the lova go out of his way to be mekayim the shtar? It's the Baal HaShtar who's going to be Mekayim the Shtar. The Mischayev creates the Shtar, he gives it over to the Baal HaShtar. In the case of a Malva, who's holding on to a Shtar from which, on the basis of which he wants to collect from a Lova, he better get that into a Mekuyim de Kishtar, because otherwise the Lova will just say whatever it'll say, Ladam, and it was Mizuyov, or Parati, whatever it'll claim. But the Lova, he's not Mekayim the Shtar. He gives the Shtar up to the Malva. It's the choice. It's up to the Malva whether he wants to be Mekayim the Shtar. And therefore to assume that these Shtaros fell from the Lovim on their way to be Mekayim the Shtar, that's not a fair assumption. We're going to have to assume that these Shtaros fell from the Malva, because the Lova does not, generally speaking, go to be Mekayim Shtar. How could it be that we found three stars from three different Lovim together? It must be that the Malva dropped the stars. The Mishnah says, Im yesh imoim simponos, yasa masha simponos. The Malva finds both a Shtar Chov, indicating that the Lova owes the money, but he finds a Simpon, a Shova from the same Lova, indicating in his own writing that the Malva accepted Piron. So he should follow the Simponos and disqualify the Chezkas Shtarchov. Omer Rab Yirmiya Bar Abba Marav, Simpon Hayotze Mitachas Yedei HaMalve. If the Shovar is in the possession of the Malve, not in the hands of the Lova, Afal Pi Shekosu B'Ksav Yodav, the Malve himself wrote up the Shovar, indicating that he received Piron, he received payment, Eino Elikim Esachek Upasol. Now, this is a little bit strange. Rabbi Yirmiyah seems to assume that the Shovar that's in the possession of the Malve, written in his own handwriting, is worthless. It's only a game that the Malva is paying with the Lova, and it's possible as a Shovar. The Shtarchov itself, in the hands of the Malva, is still valid, it's active, and he can collect the Chov with the Shtar Milva in his hand. Forget about the Shovar. So the Gemara now explains what Rav Yirmiyah had in mind. What does he mean? Afal Pisha Kosu B'Ksav Yodo. Lomi Boy. He says, I want to tell you a Chiddush. I don't have to tell you in the simple case. Lo mi boy kosu b'ksav yodo, b'ksav yad sofer. In the classical case where the shovar was written by a scribe, the ikol of meimer, and there's a very strong svar to say that safra is rami leva kosav, that the sofer, his dami lo lamalve, v'kosav lo es hashovar. In other words, even though the lov had not yet paid up the chov, on a temporary basis, the Malva commissioned the sofer to write up the shtar shovar. But the Malva, although he's very eager to have the shovar mizuma biyado, you know, he wants to have it ready in his pocket, so that if in event the lova comes to pay back the chov, he'll be able to immediately offer him a shovar. Otherwise, the lova might procrastinate. The Malva doesn't know to write the shofar himself. He needs a sofer for that. And therefore, B'pama Rishona, on the very first occasion that he met the sofer, and the sofer showed up in the locale of the Malva, he asked the sofer to please write for him a shofar. In other words, the Malva is very eager to have the shofar prepared in the drawer. In such a case, then clearly, the writing of the shofar does not in any way prove and establish that the shtar was parua. The chiddush of Rabbi Yirmiyah is elafilu, even in a situation where kosav b'ksav yado, the malva himself wrote the shofar. And lechora, we would say in that case, we should argue that if the lova did not pay up the chov, and he still owes the chov, why did the malva haste with such urgency write this shovar? I mean, he there's nothing urgent about it. It wasn't that he needed the services of the sofer, because only the sofer could write the shtar shovar, and he cannot. And as soon as he found the sofer knocking on his on one of the doors on his block, he immediately invited the sofer to write the shovar. No. What's the rush? What's urgent here? He knows this malva that he can write a shovar whenever it's necessary. If the lova comes to pay back the chov, then on the spot, afinard, as we say in Yiddish, he'll write a shovar. And therefore, in this case, that the shovar was written in the ksav yad of the malva, we have every reason to assume that this shovar was actually prepared because the lover came in to pay back his chov. And Rav Yirmiya says, afal pichein, even though, circumstances seem to indicate that the chov was paid up, nevertheless the shovar is possible. And the shtar chov retains its chezkas kashrus, which testifies that there was no piron. And the reason for that is, says the Gemara, sovar dilma misrami v'osi ben hashmashos v'kaparili. Maybe he'll come in the middle of the night, the lova, on Erev Shabbos, it's going to be too late to write a shovar, and he wants to pay me, and it's Erev Shabbos, I got to get the piron, I don't have a shovar ready, I am going to prepare the shovar in advance. And so that even though the malva has the expertise to write a shovar whenever he so desires, he's an expert at that, but he wants to have the shtar shovar prepared in advance. He knows the malva that if the lova is going to insist, I'm not willing to pay you up until you give me a shovar. So echtov hanoa dechiaisi lizuze. He wants to be very well prepared in event that he needs to give that shovar in order to retrieve his monies to gain from the lova his payment. Is then the chiaisi lizuzi, when the lova is ready to pay me back, immediately, even if it's Erev Shabbos Ben Hashmashos, etinle, I'll be ready to give him the shofar. So it's mezumen biyadi. He's ezu chacham aros adol, he's already anticipating what might happen down the line. And therefore, the ksivas hashovar on the part of the malva, even in his own ksav yad, does not prove anything as far as the piron achov. And therefore, we go back and rely on the shtar chov. So all this is Rabbi Yirmiya, but it's against our Mishnah. Tnan, our Mishnah says, in Yeshimon Simponos, that if the Malva finds amongst his shtaros, one of which is a shtar against Levi, then he finds a Simpon amongst the shtare chov, is Yasemash Simponos. Then he should live up and fulfill that which is written in the shofar, namely that the chov was paid up. That's what it says in the shofar. So state in the shofar. And therefore it's clear from our Mishnah that if the shofar, even though it's in the hands of the malva, and you might argue, as Rabbi Yirmiya did, that maybe the malva was just preparing it in advance, but in fact the piron chov never had taken place, but nevertheless, the Mishnah establishes that the fact that this piron, this shtar, shovar was written is proof positive that the lova paid up the chov. The shovar is kosher, and that undermines the status of the shtar chov. So we have here what seems to be at the face of it a head-on collision between our Mishnah and Rabbi Yirmiya. And the Gemara answers, Kida Omar of Safra. We're going to have to invoke the answer of Rav Safra. And Rav Safra offered this answer not in the context of this Mishnah that we're studying now about Yeshimon Simponos here in Bab Metzia, but in the context of a Lechora Stira on Rabbi Yirmiya from a Mishnah in Masechta Shavuos on Daf Mem Hei. And Rav Safra said that Mishnah has to be interpreted in a case of Shenimtza Bein Hashtar Sakruim, that the malva has a bunch of shtaros which are ripped up, and he finds a shovar amongst in this bunch. Now, all the shtaros that are ripped up were already paid up. Therefore, the malva doesn't have any use for them, right? He's not going to come back and collect from the lova on a shtar that's already perua, so he rips them up. Now, in this case, even Rabbi Yirmiyahu be Moda, that even though he finds the shofar in the hands of the malva, the shofar is definitely kosher. And the shtachov is becheskas parua. Why is that? Because if we're going to say that the chov is not paid up, and the malva wrote the shofar himself or through the sofer in order to anticipate the possibility of piron, that it should be mezumen biyada to give to the lova when the lova comes to pay the chomer, if that be the case, why did the malva place this shofar amongst the shtar's kruim, which he doesn't need anymore? He definitely needs the shofar. We're going to have to assume, therefore, that the lova already paid up the chov, right? The lova already paid up the chov, and the malva wrote a shofar. Okay, the lova left the shofar in the hands of the malva. That was an oversight on his part, and therefore the malva took that shtar shofar and he threw it together with all the shtar's kruim in one, you know, rubbish pile, because he doesn't need the shofar anymore. The lova's already paid him up. And Hachinami, that's exactly what our Mishnah is talking about, is Mitzo Bein Shtaros Kruim. That in our Mishnah, the Malva finds the Shovar amongst the Shtaros Kruim, and therefore the din is that he should assume that this Shovar is a Shovar Kosher. Again, if he finds the Shovar, if the shofar is in the hands of the malva, but it's together with other shtaros that are whole, complete, wholesome shtaros, that's one thing. Then there's no proof that would indicate that the malva has no use for the shofar, and then we could apply the svar, activate the svar from Yirmiyah, that Enochinami, the malva, prepared this shofar, and he plans to use it down the line, and therefore the shofar doesn't tell me a thing. But if, on the other hand, the shofar was found amongst shtar's kruim, that is proof positive that the shtar was already parua, the chov was already parua, like all the other shtars in this bunch that are kruim. And although the lova did not take the shofar, which he should have done, that was only an oversight, but in fact the payment was already implemented. So again, just to summarize the maskana, the sugya, We had what we thought was a steer between our Mishnah, which validates the Simpon, and Rabbi Yirmiyahu, who invalidates the Simpon. And the answer is, it all depends. Where did he find this Simpon? If he found it in a way that indicates clearly that the Simpon was, like all the other shtaros, an indication that the chov was paid up, in that case, we're going to rely on the simpon. And that's going to be the case which Rav Safra has set up for the Mishnah in Shavuos, and is equally applicable here to our Mishnah. The shtar shofar was found amongst the shtar's kruim. It means that the malva has no longer use for it. It means that it was already given to the lova, or it wasn't given to the lova, but the lova indeed paid the chov back and inadvertently left the shtar in the hands of the malva. But in the absence of that proof, what we're going to assume is that the shofar is irrelevant. The shofar was as Rabbi Yirmiyahu would have it, a move, an action that was done on the part of the malva to prepare himself in advance if, in event, the lova would come to be porea the chov. Now the Gemara is going to ask a kasha on Rabbi Yirmiyahu from a Mishnah in Masechta Bava Basra, because that Mishnah towards the end of Bava Basra, about a city in which there were two Yosef ben Shimons living in the same city, v'nimtza li'echad bein shtarosav, if one of them with the name Yosef ben Shimon finds amongst his shtaros a shovar, and that shovar says, shtaros shel Yosef ben Shimon that is in my hands, paruahu, in other words, that Yosef ben Shimon already paid me up, and the malva indeed has two shtaros on the name of Yosef ben Shimon, in other words, he extended a loan to two people with the same name, he doesn't remember which one of them wrote, on behalf of which one of them he wrote a shovar, is the din is that shtaros shneim pruim, we have to assume that both Lovim had paid up the chov. He can't collect from either one of them, because each one of them has a right to say, I was the one who paid you up, and you wrote and prepared this shover for me, and therefore, motzi mechaver v'raya, you can't force me to pay. Again, that's something that we have to analyze here, the how we apply motzi mechaver v'raya. But in any event, it's clear from the Mishnah that even though the shover is found in the possession of the malveh, nevertheless, the shover is kosher, and the malveh cannot claim that he did not receive payment for that shover. One of the two shtaros, one of the two chovos, was definitely paid up. Again, the malva doesn't remember which one, but one of them was definitely paid up, and he knows that from the shover. That's a contradiction, a blatant contradiction to Rabbi Yirmiyah. And the Gemara once again applies the logic of Rav Safra. Kedomer Rav Safra, shenimtza bein shtaros kruim. Why is it that the malva takes the shtar so seriously? This shofar, because he finds the shofar amongst the shtaros kruim, and in such a case, even Rabbi Yirmiyah is moed that the shofar is definitely kosher and it's reliable, as we explained earlier, because all these shtaros that are kruim were shtaros that were used, and the malva no longer has a use for them, and that's why he ripped them up. He no longer has a use for the shovar because he's already received payment for the lova. And if the lova didn't collect the shovar, that's the lova's tuckflock. But the shovar does and is reliably testifying that the lova paid up the chov. So whenever you find a shtar shovar amongst shtaros kruim, that's where Rabbi Yirmiyah would also agree that we take that shovar very, very seriously. And in this case, where we don't know which of the two, Yosef and Shimon's, paid up his debt, we're going to have to apply the principle of motzi mechaver v'raya, and the malva is going to have to pay both of them. And perhaps this concept of motzi mechaver v'raya is based on what we call a chezkas chiyuv. That's something in Mirtz Hashem that we'll have to take up in the next shiur. I want to take this opportunity to wish everyone a Chag Sukkos Kosher V'Sameach. I'm not sure if I'll get a chance to do the shiur for Daf. We're almost up to Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph, which would set us into a new Perek, but we'll leave the Siyum in Mirtz Hashem for the next shiur, which is... Again, there's not that much left up to the parish, but it's always good to leave a siyum for Chol HaMoed, Mirtz Hashem, B'Shatova, U'Mutzlachas.